Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. So as you've been hearing in the news today, former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger died yesterday at the age of 100. The obits have been running along a spectrum mostly of harsh to harsher to harshest. Maybe the harshest headline is in Rolling Stone, which says, Henry Kissinger, war criminal, finally dies. Go Google Kissinger obits for some samples of being willing to speak ill about the dead, and right away. One headline somewhere on that spectrum is from an article that Slate's military and foreign affairs columnist Fred Kaplan wrote back in May when Kissinger had his 100th birthday. That headline read, Henry Kissinger's Bloody Legacy. Fred Kaplan joins us now. Besides writing for Slate, he is author of books including his latest, The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War, another nuclear weapons book from the 1980s called The Wizards of Armageddon, and one that Fred wrote in 2008 called Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. We'll see if Henry Kissinger came up with any of those ideas. And we'll talk about Fred's 100th birthday article, which again was called Henry Kissinger's Bloody Legacy. Fred, thanks for coming on. As always, welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, good to be here, as always.
So you wrote in that 100 Candle Power piece in May that Chile is the darkest blotch on Kissinger's legacy. We have generations of listeners who weren't around for Kissinger when he did whatever he did with Chile in 1973. You want to tell everybody about it?
Well, Chile elected, in a fair and free election, a socialist, Salvador Allende, and Kissinger basically plotted to overthrow him, saying, why should we allow a socialist country in our hemisphere just because the people in the country were irresponsible? Now, the reason why it's the darkest, it's not necessarily the most damaging thing that Kissinger did, but it's the one incident where the blame for what subsequently happened can be laid entirely on Kissinger. Many other things, it could be Kissinger and Nixon, or Kissinger and somebody else. But in this one, Nixon was actually about to have an appointment with a State Department underling of Kissinger's to talk about possibly forming some kind of modus vivendi with the Allende government. Kissinger got that meeting canceled and went to Nixon himself and convinced him that, no, we have to make the Chilean economy scream. And he headed a secret, Kissinger, who was National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, became the chairman of a special committee, which consisted largely of CIA agents, to overthrow the Chilean government. And they worked hand in hand with the Teamsters, which organized a big trucker strike in Chile so that the economy would scream. And, you know, what ultimately happened is that Allende was overthrown by General Pinochet, who then launched a campaign to arrest and kill thousands of dissidents, during which time Kissinger told him, basically, do what you need to do, and instructed the State Department not to issue any démarches against what he was doing. And you know, later, Pinochet was found by the international courts to be a war criminal and was barred from many countries. He was almost arrested once when he went to England. So, you know, this is something. Oh, and one of the murders by Pinochet and his people took place in the streets of Washington, D.C. An exile economist named Orlando Letelier was blown up with a car bomb as his car drove by the Chilean embassy, killing him and an American colleague. There's never been any apologies for any of this.
Oh, that's just what I was going to ask. If Kissinger ever expressed regret for empowering Pinochet and all that he brought.
No, he, for one thing, the full extent of the U.S. involvement in this wasn't even revealed until years later when Seymour Hersh uncovered it for the New York Times. It was denied until documents came out confirming it. Kissinger had this, you know, among many other things, Kissinger was actually a witty man. And often he would just not address charges like this. Sometimes he would kind of dismiss it with a joke. I mean, for example, one time he said something like, illegal things we do very quickly. Unconstitutional things, it takes a little longer. And, you know, everybody, ha, 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 ha. Mm. You know, he charmed people with this kind of thing. He, you know, there have been books. There have been whole books written about each one of the places in the world where Kissinger did dreadful things.
One but, that you know, people probably are not very familiar with that you cite in your article is him being soft on a human rights violating coup in Pakistan, which you say led to the deaths of millions of civilians. Millions?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is Gary Bass wrote a book about just this some time ago based on declassified documents. Yeah, there was a coup in East Pakistan led by a General Aga Muhammad Yahya. And because Pakistan was aligned with China, Kissinger against India, Kissinger did not want, there's one memo where he tells his staff, don't squeeze Yahya. And Nixon and Kissinger were both very complicit in what went on. They used American weapons to do what they did. Yeah, because, you know, the horrible thing is that things that happen in places like East Pakistan, another one was Indonesia's invasion of East Timor, which resulted in the deaths of about 100,000 civilians. These kinds of spots on the map tend to be overlooked. The politics involved are very complicated. I think there's probably some racial things that go into a lot of people just not taking a close look. You know, Argentina was another case where there was a coup that he turned a blind eye to the excesses of killing thousands of dissidents and making them disappear. You might remember that phrase from the time. And in fact, in that instance, he told the foreign minister of Argentina, we would like you to succeed. That is to succeed in suppressing these dissidents. The bombing of North Vietnam and Cambodia, you know, those are probably the deadliest things that he was involved in. But there he
shares
the
stage. And probably the most well-known.
Yeah, yeah, because we were involved in a war there at the time. So it were thousands of Americans were getting killed, too. There, you know, he shares responsibility full bore with President Nixon as well.
He also shared a Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating an end to the Vietnam War. Do you think that at least was deserved or that his escalation policies helped hasten the war's end in any way?
No, I think it's disgraceful. For one thing, it's long since been shown that when Nixon was running for president in 68, and Kissinger was signed on to be his national security advisor, Kissinger arranged for communications to be sent to South Vietnam, whose leaders were engaged in peace talks with North Vietnam in Paris at the time, saying, don't negotiate, you'll get a better deal when Nixon is president. This was while President Johnson was negotiating talks. So, and there was progress in these talks. Now, it may or may not be that those talks would have resulted in an end to the war. But Kissinger's communique to the South Vietnamese leaders to hold on, don't take any deal now, you'll get a better one from Nixon, that very well could have prolonged the war by many years and tens of thousands of American deaths. So then the peace treaty that he did come up with, you know, wasn't really a peace treaty at all. It was just a way to provide cover for an American withdrawal and an almost instantaneous collapse of the South Vietnamese government.
listeners.
So no, that's one of the Nobel Prize's least stellar chapters.
Listeners, any comments or questions about the legacy of Henry Kissinger, who died yesterday at the age of 100? For Fred Kaplan from Slate, 212-433 WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call or text. And I think TJ in Manhattan wants to bring up something that he says Kissinger said very recently. TJ, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning to you and to your guest. I'm calling about recently during the war between Russia and Ukraine. Kissinger went to Zelensky, President Zelensky of Ukraine, and told him to calm down the Russian by giving up all the area, the Donetsk area, where the Russia basically invaded and give it to them. You know, Zelensky was extremely angry and said, no way. And the idea was extremely mocked. So that proves that Kissinger is not the smart guy everybody wants to talk about.
TJ, thank you very much. Do you have anything, Fred, on him taking a position on Ukraine-Russia?
In some fairness, this is an article he wrote for the Financial Times, I think. He talked about making a trade of land for security, and he said that as part of this deal, Ukraine would be allowed into NATO. But yeah, it would give up some land. And in some fairness, it may well be that if this war ever does end, a deal of that sort might be what ends up getting struck. But for the moment, for someone as prominent as Kissinger to come up with a suggestion like this could really only have the effect of emboldening Putin to stay away from any negotiating table under the possibility that he might get a better deal down the road. I would at some point, there are some good things that Kissinger did, and we should talk about that at some point as well.
In fact, that's where I was going to go next, to something that I think you would consider a good thing. Kissinger was on this show in 2011 when he wrote a book called On China. And another part of his legacy that you may have just been referring to was leading President Nixon to his famous opening to China and trip to China. I asked Kissinger about criticism he got from the right at that time for his policies of detente with Russia and China, rather than taking a harder line like when President Reagan came into office in the following decade and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. This is the China part of Kissinger's answer.
Now, as far as Mao is as far as China is concerned, the opening to China did not legitimize Mao. Mao was in office. The common consensus at the period was followed by every other democratic government and preceded by other democratic governments, that China needed to be brought into the international system if one was going to have progress towards peace. And the idea that we should have added a confrontation with China to a crisis in Vietnam is something that's easy to do in 2011. It was not a thoughtful policy then.
Henry Kissinger here in 2011 when he was only 88. How do you think of that side of Kissinger's legacy, Fred?
No, that's certainly one of his, for the most part, positive legacies. Bringing China into the international system was a major boon, both to getting people millions out of poverty in China, and also some economic development within the rest of the world. And also, Kissinger also meant it, as did Nixon, as a game of triangular politics with Russia, joining up with China to put more pressure on the Soviet Union and trying to use it as some kind of leverage in the Vietnam War, which had no effect whatsoever. What happened later, though, was that when it turned out that by joining the international system, China was becoming stronger, but it was not adopting democratic ways, and it was engaging in unfair trade practices and things like that. Kissinger remained a cheerleader for China, excusing them on for everything that they did. And, you know, his death was, you know, the Chinese government praised him as a friend of the Chinese people. Well, he wasn't a friend of the Chinese people. He was a very good friend of the Chinese Communist Party for justifying everything that they did. He became, he had lots of contracts with what was called Kissinger Associates, where his alliance with China paid plenty of bounties. So, no, it was a major, major thing, and it transformed world politics, mainly in a good way. But when this started to have some negative side effects, Henry Kissinger was not any of those, even trying to pressure the Chinese government quietly to back off on some of its practices.
Carolina in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carolina.
Hi, Brian. Long time, first time. I'm calling because last night, right after I read the news, my mother called me on a video call. And my mother's from Chile. She grew up in Santiago, and she was a teenager in 1973 when the coup happened. And her family's house, like, she grew up just a few blocks from the National Stadium, which, if anybody knows the history of the coup and the stadium, there were just mass executions there. And one of the worst, most notorious terror cells was just a few blocks away from her home. So, you know, 1973 was awful for many reasons. You know, we had family that had to flee the country to go to East Germany. And there was a moment where my grandmother hid a cousin in the home because she knew that she was going to likely be murdered before she was able to escape. And so that's the background for this. When I told my mom, she didn't know. I said, "Mommy, did you know that Kissinger just died?" I mean, to be honest, I didn't even know he was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when I told her, he just died. He was 100. Like, he lived to see 100, and he caused the death of so many youth. And just looking at her face, like, the relief, and she started to weep. And, you know, this was 50 years ago, but the pain that he caused so many people, it was something to behold, seeing how she reacted to the news of this man has finally left this earth after all of the pain he caused.
Such a powerful story and personal like that. Carolina, thank you so much. Wow, Fred.
Yeah, well, this, you know, you could go into certain countries that don't, you know, have big blips on our radar screen and find lots of people who would tell similar stories.
John.
And very few people telling opposite stories, actually.
John in East Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm with the East Timor Action Network, and Kissinger has been our white whale, so to speak, since we were founded. He and Ford gave the green light to Indonesia's invasion of East Timor in 1975, literally the day before the invasion was launched. And that quote about the illegal we do immediately, the unconstitutional takes a bit longer, is from minutes of a meeting, I think the following March, where they're discussing how to keep the weapons flow from the U.S. to Indonesia, despite U.S. laws that say countries that invade, allies that invade other countries, are supposed to get their weapons cut off. And since we're talking death tolls here, the estimates are 100,000 to 200,000. East Timorese died as a result of the U.S.-backed invasion of East Timor by Indonesia.
John, thank you for making that a little more well-known to many of our listeners who may never have heard of East Timor. Go ahead, Fred.
Now, the notes that you refer to in this meeting, Kissinger addresses the fact that it would be illegal to send arms to Indonesia for an invasion. And he said, well, if we can refer to this action as self-defense, then we could get it done. And he instructed his legal staff to come up with some completely nonsense way of justifying the Indonesian government's action as self-defense.
So
in that case, you know, he knew it was illegal and just manipulated the facts to allow it.
And yet, despite everything we've been talking about, didn't all the presidents, even after Nixon and Ford, who he officially served, including all the Democrats, through Obama, use him as an advisor and maybe even Biden?
Yeah, but I don't know how seriously, actually. I mean, in some ways, it was almost kind of an initiation rite where it shows that you're a serious on foreign policy, but you sit down with the most serious sounding foreign policy specialist in the United States. I mean, I know that in his long article, his long set of interviews with Jeffrey Goldberg, President Obama, had very disparaging things to say about Kissinger and his impact on the world. But you're right. Even if some presidents did this more for show, it was a show to everybody else. It perpetuated this perception that this guy was a great mind and a great statesman and somebody to look up to and to call for advice. And it also perpetuated, this is where it really counts. He formed this think tank. It wasn't really a think tank. It was called Kissinger Associates. And he advised foreign governments and was paid by foreign governments. And so the fact that he was being greeted into the Oval Office by every president and at least seemingly asked for advice strengthened his standing among clients. They thought that, oh, when we hire Kissinger, not only are we getting this brilliant foreign policy thinker, but we're getting somebody who has an in into the White House. We are going to use him. We could use him as a vehicle for influence, for getting our views across. So in that sense, the show, the theatrics, in which these presidents were complicit, misled leaders in other countries
and,
as well.
And you could have a flip side of that and ask, why did U.S. presidents take advice and continue to take advice from somebody who they knew was being paid by foreign governments to press their interests on us? But I want to raise one more thing before you go. I also asked Kissinger when he was on the show that day in 2011 a question about his childhood and its influence on his approach to foreign policy. Here's a little of that, beginning with part of my question.
You were a refugee from the Nazis. You served in the U.S. military in hazardous intelligence duty during World War II. People rarely talk about that part of your life.
Well, before that, in hazardous infantry duty, and then in hazardous intelligence duty.
Yes. And since you came of age at that time, can you put into words what, if anything, the horror of Nazism did to shape your worldview or your desire to work in foreign policy?
Look, Hitler came to power when I was barely 9 years old. And from that point on, the Jewish community in Germany was segregated and came under increasing pressure, excluded from public places, and then in time under physical attack. And as kids, you were immediately under physical attack, because every Hitler Youth boy could beat you up in the street. So that was the reality that I saw, and I saw a world disintegrate. So I have tried to devote my life to promoting peace as I understood it, as I've just explained it to you, and also to try to heal divisions in this country. And one reason some on the left and some on the right are attacking me, because they think I ought to belong to them. And I try to take a position that stands above these disputes.
Henry Kissinger here in 2011, obviously relevant today as we watch anti-Semitism come out in frightening ways, but Fred, also kind of mind-boggling that he positioned his lesson from growing up in Nazi Germany to be someone who worked for peace, given everything we've been talking about regarding his legacy. So any reaction to that clip or Kissinger positioning himself as a pragmatist, not left or right?
Yes, very interesting. The thing to sum up about Kissinger's worldview, which is reflected also in some books that he wrote both before and after he was in power, some of which are very good, by the way, he was the kind of a key figure in the Realpolitik school of international studies, which is the idea that you don't focus on morality so much as in maintaining a balance of power, in following your own national security interests and recognizing that other countries followed their national security interests. And I'm sure that there is a whole generation of scholars coming out of World War II that thought that the way that you maintain the peace is not through these hyper-idealistic visions of a world government or international law as followed World War I, but to maintain the balance of power and keeping, deterrence through strength, that sort of thing. And he did have that going for him. However, most of the other practitioners or theorists of the Realpolitik school, and I'm thinking of people like George Kennan and Hans Morgenthau and Kenneth Waltz, had as their underlying premises something about American values. Kennan said, who invented the whole idea of containment against the Soviet Union, the idea was that you have a long, persistent patience in containing the Soviet Union, and in the meantime, making your own system look appealing so that people actually come over to the American side. And that's one reason, that's one way that we did defeat the Soviet Union in the Cold War.
So in our last minute, did that, the way you're describing it, Kissinger's relationship with Realpolitik, as that's called, come up in your book, how a few grand ideas wrecked American power, or did he come up in either of your books on nuclear weapons, real briefly?
Well, he did have, he changed his mind on nuclear weapons. In the 1950s, he thought that you could use battlefield nuclear weapons to defeat the Soviet Union at a battlefield. Later, he said, no, it would probably escalate all the way to nuclear, and therefore was a proponent of building up a conventional defense. Actually, my book, Daydream Believers, is mainly about the neocons, of which he is not a member, who thought that you could use very moralistic pronouncements about the United States to advance our power. He was actually on the other side of that. But what I was...
Does that mean he was against George Bush's Iraq war?
Well, he says that he was privately, but he wasn't publicly. He supported... I can't think of a single American intervention that he publicly spoke out against.
Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate. He wrote on the occasion of Henry Kissinger's 100th birthday earlier this year, a Slate article which is now being recirculated called Henry Kissinger's Bloody Legacy. Fred, thank you so much.
Anytime.